Hello everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, and today in Reykjavik I'm recording on a Saturday night, Saturday the 17th of September. It's a sunny evening. We had some northern lights this week. We had some beautiful northern lights, green and yellow and blue and purple swirls just all over the sky. It's really something to see. It's that time of year here in Reykjavik. It's the autumn time where you get clear skies. The darkness is returning. We probably get northern lights all year round, you know, but you just don't see them in the summer because it's never dark. So it's that northern light season again. I posted a few pictures of the aurora over on the show's Discord, and people were really happy to see them. It's really something to see. It's also been a bit of a crazy week for video games. A lot to see there too. We have had a whole bunch of showcases. We had a Nintendo Direct. We had an Ubisoft Forward. We had a Sony and Xbox event. So I'm going to talk through a little bit of that news. I get the feeling that anyone that listens to any gaming podcasts will have heard a lot of people listing off all the games that were announced. So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to pick out a handful of games that really caught my attention and that maybe you'll be hearing about on this show at some point. So just highlighting a few games that leapt out, some of the blockbusters, but some of the smaller ones too. But I've also had time to play a few games this week. I've been playing more Rogue Legacy 2, and I have a few more thoughts on that. That's going to be a game that just ticks over on the show. It's a long-term play, that one. I played a little bit of Bear and Breakfast, so I'm going to talk about that one. I played a little bit of Harvestella, and I finished a game on Game Pass that I picked up on a whim, not really knowing what it was exactly, but that's the good thing about Game Pass. You can just pick something up and try it. It turned out that this game was 2 hours long and quite delightful. It's been on Game Pass for a year now or so, I haven't heard anyone talking about this one, really. I get the feeling that it fell a little flat upon release, but I had a really good time with it, and I've decided to make it the featured game of this episode, and that game is The Beasts of Maravilla Island, so I'll be talking about that one a little bit later on as well. But before we get into all that, let's run through some of the news. The Nintendo Direct was the one that I saw the most speculation about online. I don't know if that's just because my slice of gamer social media are people that are Nintendo-leaning. I get the feeling it's pretty split, to be honest. But there just seemed to be a little more fascination around this Nintendo Direct. There was a lot of speculation about remasters of classics, none of which came true. But there was quite a lot there. This was a really meaty Direct. It was like 40 minutes long. But I'm just going to talk through a couple games that leapt out to me. First up, there was a couple games that people have been expressing interest about that haven't been able to play because of platforms. It was a couple of ports. There is a port of Tunic coming later in the month, I believe, and a port of It Takes Two, which was that, you know, very lauded, garlanded Game of the Year last year after the Game Awards. I've tried to play both of these games, and I bounced on both of them, to be honest with you. I think I'm going to have another go at both of them at some point, because I do like to try and get to the bottom of why critically acclaimed games are so loved. And those two, there's definitely quality in both of them, but neither of them really sang to me on my first playthrough, but I'm going to try them. And I've got a feeling that a lot of people are going to try both of those on Switch. I think Tunic, being so Zelda-inspired, so clearly Zelda-inspired, with that little Link-like fox in his green smock, and It Takes Two being a two-player game that you could use Joy-Cons for, they're both ideally suited for the Switch. So those were the two ports that leapt out to me. The next thing I saw in the Direct was Harvestella. This is a JRPG mixed with a farming game from Squaresoft. This is a really funny mixture, and I'm going to talk more about this game in a while because I have played the demo, and part of this announcement was that a demo is out on Switch now. So I'm going to hold fire on that one, but I've got some things to say about it, having played the demo for a fair few hours, actually. It's a substantial demo. Another one that caught my attention was IB. This is an RPG maker game, so it's one of those top-down pixel art, old-style RPGs. This one is set in an art gallery, and it seems to have a horror element to it. Someone is sucked into the paintings and they have to deal with all kinds of, I don't know, feelings, demons, that kind of thing. But it turns out that this game is actually an older game. I think it came out in 2012 or 13. It's in the vein of To the Moon, if you've played that one. I've covered it on the show. It's another 16-bit style top-down RPG with pixel art. So I'm very curious to play Ib. I heard Sarah Pazorski talking about it on Minmax show, and she was saying that for her this was a really funny one to see because everyone throughout her gaming life has been nostalgic towards the 90s, towards games that she never played. And for her, this was the first time that a game like Ib that she grew up with has come around again. And so it was a very special moment for her. So that one was quite a funny one to hear, that Ib is well known to people that had their eye on the ball at that period. I'd never heard of Ib before, but it looks like an interesting one. We also got an announcement for Pikmin 4. I think everyone knew this one was coming, but Shigeru Miyamoto came and flashed us with a Pikmin 4 t-shirt in that style that Japanese developers have been doing lately. This is going to be an interesting one. I'm an original fan of Pikmin. I played the original game on the GameCube and was very taken with it. When I think back to it now, I think I hadn't played a game before with that many little characters on the screen, especially not under your control. And I remember just their little heads that come up to red and blue points with a leaf on the top. And they all sway in unison. And I've got a very strong memory of sitting in my old bedroom in a flat in London, playing this game on an old TV, and just seeing all of these little creatures swaying in unison with their little tendril heads and leaves in air, and following me around like ants in formation. And it was a very unusual gaming experience. So I've been a Pikmin fan. I've played a couple of the games over the years. I will say that being a fan of it, I am also pretty critical of Pikmin. I have found the games to often be frustrating because of the timer, because of the eccentricities of controlling your Pikmin. And there have been a couple post-Pikmin games that I actually fell in love with fully, such as The Wild at Heart, which you may have heard me talking about on the show, and Tinykin, which I reviewed last week. So I kind of feel like there are better Pikmin games out there than the Pikmin games. And I'm just curious if Nintendo have been paying attention to that. You know, if we look at Breath of the Wild, they'd clearly been looking at video game trends. So I'm curious if they have done the same with Pikmin 4 and if they're going to address some of those inbuilt issues with the format and bring it up to spec and kind of sand the edges off it for us. So I'm looking forward to Pikmin 4. I will definitely play it. I just have a lot of thoughts on the Pikmin genre. There are more games than you would think, and I'm happy to hear that. I'm happy about that. Pikmin really did coin a genre, you know, and it's not often that a game can say that. But the big event of this one was the unveiling of the release date and title of the new entry in the Legend of Zelda series after Breath of the Wild. We've all been referring to this one as Breath of the Wild 2 for years and years and years. Breath of the Wild came out way back in 2017, so it's getting on for 6 years since that one came out. It's a pretty substantial period of time for a game to be in development. You would imagine that this had been in development for most of that time on some level, especially when it turned out to be such a globe-conquering, era-defining game as Breath of the Wild. It's still funny to me that given games like Witcher 3 and games like Red Dead Redemption, with the level of realism that they bring visually, and they are in some ways more complex games than the Zelda game. It's funny to me that Breath of the Wild is the one that Nintendo somehow managed to capture lightning in a bottle, and that it became the era-defining game. It's probably the definitive open-world game. Even if people disagree with that statement, I can hear you all screaming at me through the screen now. But it probably is the one that people talk about the most, you know. It's the one that people use as a yardstick for the genre. It's the most influential. You hear people talking about post-Breath of the Wild games. I feel like Breath of the Wild has stayed in the conversation in a way that no other open-world game really has. And I mean, I understand that. I have a very personal connection with Breath of the Wild. It was the game that this show is partially named after. It was the first game that I played after my hiatus from gaming. It was the game that I've spent the most time in ever, I would say, quite easily. I think I have 226 hours in it last time I looked. And it's a very special game to me that helped me through a difficult period of my life. It was an escape into the screen when I was at rock bottom, basically. So that place has a very, very special place in my heart. I feel very connected to that game in a way that is quite unique, I think. And I think a lot of people do too. This is a story that I've heard bouncing around, that Breath of the Wild was a game that got people through things somehow. And that's pretty special, isn't it? I mean, it is a game where you get to run through beautiful nature, through a vast kingdom with huge trees, mountains, like really genuinely impressive, epic mountains. Mount Hebron is a very memorable gaming experience. It's genuinely huge, and it's also genuinely hostile. It takes a long time before you can really be comfortable even running around on Mount Hebron because it's too high, it's too cold. It will finish off Link unless you have the right clothing, unless you have the right food, all that kind of stuff. So it really does give you a taste of the actual difficulties of nature in some way. Like, the world is so big and so difficult and so vertical, but also just so beautiful and welcoming as well. I have nothing but good memories of Breath of the Wild. Some of my best gaming memories are of Breath of the Wild, such as running along on a horse by some cliffs by the sea at night, and it was raining and the sun came up, and I turned the camera and just saw this beautiful sunrise, the light rippling over the water, the light catching the rocks, the wet rocks that I was galloping over. And it was just kind of emotional in a way. I don't know how to describe it. Breath of the Wild is a special, special game. And so the fact that there's a new game coming is great news. I'm very excited about it. And it was named for us. This one is called The Legend of Zelda: Tears of the Kingdom. My first take on that name was, I mean, Breath of the Wild is such a great name for that game. It gives you the whole vibe of getting like the wind in your hair and your eyes scanning the horizon and just vastness and nature. And Tears of the Kingdom is different. Tears, melancholy, obviously, kingdom. It's gives it a certain historicity. So the Tears of the Kingdom feels like an oddly melancholic plot-led title for the game, especially given the fact that this game seems to include lots of underground sequences and lots of airborne sequences from all of the material that we've seen so far. So there is room here for another inspirational title like Breath of the Wild was, but instead they've gone for something more plot-led, something like sad. It's a sad title, The Tears of the Kingdom. So I'm very curious to see how that title plays out through the game. You know, I'm sure that the game is going to have all of that gameplay and all of that vastness and traversal. We saw in the trailer Link diving through clouds and climbing up air islands that look like a castle in the sky from Studio Ghibli. So there's lots of magic here. We also saw Link landing on what looked like a flying platform, a winged platform. Maybe that will be like an airborne vehicle that Link can use to get around more quickly. And that's a welcome change for me. I mean, Immortals Phoenix Rising, which is basically Ubisoft's Breath of the Wild tribute, did actually improve on some of the mechanics in Breath of the Wild, such as being a winged character. You were able to fly through the air rapidly and to dive through the air rather than slowly descending like you can with the paraglider in Breath of the Wild. So it would be nice to see some of that being absorbed into the new Breath of the Wild game. I'm still going to be calling it Breath of the Wild 2 for a long time, I think. Tears of the Kingdom hasn't really sunk in yet. But I'm very, very curious for that game. It's my most anticipated game. Everyone in the show's Discord has been picking up Breath of the Wild and playing it in anticipation. So I think that the world is just gasping to get their hands on this game. And it was a really good reveal, I thought. It's coming out on the 12th of May next year. And I guess that was a hard act to follow for Sony, but they had a state of play. They unveiled, I think, 10 games. I've noted down only two. There was some stuff in there that isn't my thing, like Tekken. There was some a whole load of slashy, soulsy, swordy, fancy games. And they all blend together for me when I watch Sony stuff. There's a game about Ronin. There's another game about samurai. There's a lot going on. There was an interesting looking mech game, but they all blend together. And so I just tend to let the dust settle on all of those games and pick out the ones that do well critically and that get buzz online and that people gravitate to. But there were a couple that sprang out to me. The first is an indie game. It's called Pacific Drive. It's a great concept. It's a driving game, but it's not a racing game. You just drive. It reminded me a little bit of Stephen King's The Fog, a short story that I'd read a long time ago that I think has been turned into, I think I've seen a film of that, and it may even have been turned into a series. But it's a game where people were driving through fog, and the world had gone wrong. There were monsters in the fog. The fog was dangerous. And this reminds me of the atmosphere of that. So you're driving through a world which has gone strange. It's like a horror world. In the trailer, we saw a car swerving to avoid balls of lightning pounding the road and strange creatures charging the car. And that sounds great. I mean, one of the best moments in horror movies is often they get into the car, they're trying to start it, the creature's coming, they drive, and are they going to make it? You know, it's like that Jurassic Park sequence where the T-Rex is snapping at the guy in the back of the truck. And so to base a game on that exciting seat-of-the-pants experience is really cool. It reminded me of another game called Beware that Louis from TimePlay 3HR has been flagging up for a while now. So maybe horror driving games are a genre that we're going to see coming forward. There's at least two in the making, and I guess Moondown that I covered last Halloween has a bit of that to it as well. You do a bit of driving in that one too. So that's Pacific Drive. But the headline event at the State of Play was God of War Ragnarok. I'm still halfway through God of War 2018. I really enjoy it. I think it is one of the most spectacular games that I've played. I tailed off it for some reason. I can't remember quite why. I was about halfway through. And I've got nothing but good things to say about it, honestly. It's a linear journey in which you play Kratos, the god of war, who has absconded after murdering the whole Greek pantheon and found himself in Nordic lands hiding away. And in God of War 2018, we see Kratos with a young son suddenly being revealed, his hiding place revealed, to the Norse pantheon. And so suddenly we have Thor, we have Odin, we have Odin the Allfather, who is voiced hilariously in the new game by Toby from The West Wing, if you've seen that show. And so now Kratos is facing off against the Norse pantheon, which is a very colourful pantheon of gods. They are very martial, militaristic warriors, but they're also super spiritual, spooky, magical gods, you know. So it's a really refreshing thing to see Kratos facing off against them. And this game looks so cool. It looks so cinematic. I mean, the first game had a battle against a dragon that I think is one of the most memorable things I've seen in a video game. The World Serpent is a presence in the first game, and it's vast. Like the way that the God of War games, the modern ones, and the originals actually, handle scale is just unparalleled, really. And we saw a little bit of that in the trailer. We saw a wolf the size of a tower block. We saw a jellyfish swim across the sky that looked more like something you'd see in a Star Trek show, like a vast space-faring jellyfish species. We saw an arrow split the sky open and turn from night to day or day to night. This is just going to be a great game. I cannot wait. It's coming out in November. I'm definitely going to be playing it. In fact, I think I should probably try and get through God of War ahead of time. Xbox had a showcase as well. I'm going to skip over this one. It was focused on Japanese games. Nothing really popped for me. There was some more samurai stuff going on, a couple indie games. Bit of a strange selection. But I will say, in Xbox's defense, that Game Pass is popping. They've had Immortality, they've had Tinykin, they've added Immortals Fenyx Rising, they've added Metal Hellsinger, they've still got Hard Space Shipbreaker coming out in just a couple days, Deathloop is coming out this month, Slime Rancher 2 is coming out this month. So Game Pass is just still leading the line, and they're having a quietly stellar autumn. Game Pass also got Assassin's Creed Odyssey recently, a game that I do recommend, at least for the first 20 hours. Maybe don't aim to finish it unless you're there for the long haul. It takes about 80 hours to get through. But I have nothing but good things to say about that opening section of Assassin's Creed Odyssey. It's really fun as you are learning all of the mechanics. Really fun, actually, you know, like notably brilliant as an open world game and really entertaining stuff with a definitely play as the female protagonist if you try it. Play as Cassandra. It's her game, really. But it is very long, you know, as Ubisoft games tend to be. There's like a kind of a 50-hour period where you're just repeating yourself again and again. So it gets a bit old, but definitely worth a try. But that leads me on to the last thing here in the news section. That is the Ubisoft Forward presentation. And I think I found myself, to my own surprise, enjoying Assassin's Creed games. They're just been super big, impressive, immersive, open-world RPGs in a historical setting. Odyssey, obviously, is about ancient Greece and the Spartans and the Athenians. Black Flag was about the pirates of the Caribbean era. And Valhalla is about the Vikings and their incursions into England. And I really enjoy these historical settings and these beautiful landscapes that these games have. And treat them like playgrounds, really, I guess. You know, you just run around climbing up stuff, looking at views and carrying out the gameplay tasks as you go. So I am a little bit of a fan of the Assassin's Creed genre as it stands now, but I'm just going to rattle through what they said. They said that Assassin's Creed Mirage will be the next game, set in Baghdad. It features a character called Basim, who is in Valhalla. He's an assassin that is in that game. So that's an interesting one. That's going to be another mainline entry. But apparently it's going to be a bit of a back-to-the-roots style of game, a little more linear and stealth-focused, which I think will make a lot of people happy. And they also gave us more information about Assassin's Creed Infinity, which is going to be the new hub area with a modern world element to it, where you get to use the Animus. And the Animus, you know, I have a strange relationship with the Assassin's Creed games in that the old plot of Assassins versus Templars or whatever it is doesn't interest me that much. Like, I missed the boat on all of that stuff. I just like them because you get to be a Viking or a Spartan. And so Assassin's Creed Infinity is going to attempt to address this issue that people want to play uninterrupted historical RPGs. And they're going to do that by centering the Animus and the modern day element, the time travel element, the virtual reality element in a hub where you can use the Animus to travel into the past. So from this hub, you'll be able to go back into a game called Codename Red, set in feudal Japan, more of a modern-day Assassin's Creed RPG, and you're going to be able to go into Hexei, which is a spooky Assassin's Creed set during the Witch Trials. So I really like this. I think this could be a really good idea. I think it could clean up the Assassin's Creed thing, you know. I think if the Animus is a hub with a modern-day element that will satisfy people who are interested in the meta plot of how this saga has played out throughout history. But then people that want to play feudal Japan can just jump into that door and they won't get interrupted and pulled back into the modern day as you do in Assassin's Creed games as they stand now. So it splits things up really nicely. You know, this is Ubisoft though, so they might have designs on Assassin's Creed Infinity being more of a glorified storefront loaded with, you know, whatever, microtransactions, NFTs, whatever the flavor of the month is for getting money from gamers. But if it goes well, I think that there is room here for this to work, you know. So that's my roundup of all of the massive amount of news that we've had in the last week. And now let's move on and talk about some games. So let's talk about a couple of games that I've added to the slate, I've added to the podcast long list. The first of them is Four Tales. This is a game that's been recommended to me by several people. It's quite an original looking card game. I have downloaded it on the Switch. I got a review code, so thank you for that to the publisher. And it looks like a game that builds on traditional card battles and the way that we think of deck builders by adding in elements of story decisions and branching paths and even exploration, all using that card game mechanic. So I'm really curious to try that one out. I've had a little look at it and the art style looks really nice. This is a very intriguing one. It's been pretty well received and I'm looking forward to playing it. The second game I've added to the slate is Blossom Tales 2, The Minotaur Prince. This was a recommendation from Discord in a thread where we were talking about our favourite Nintendo-inspired games. This was a thread inspired by Tinykin and Pikmin. And Blossom Tales 2 came up as one of the better Zelda-inspired games that has come out over the years. I've played a bit of it. It's a top-down 2D Zelda tribute, a full-on tribute to the golden age of the Zelda pixel art era. But it does add some interesting things to it. There is more gameplay here than in games like A Link to the Past. It's a modern update of it, and it looks lovely on the Switch screen, very crisp, very beautiful. So I'm really happy to be playing Blossom Tales 2. It's my chill-out game at the moment, and I'll be talking about it more in the future. I also added Nobody Saves the World. This is a game that I've talked about before. I think it was one of the first games I talked about this year. It's got a DLC called the Frozen Hearth DLC. I'm working my way through this game. I'm about 60% of the way through it on the Switch. I play it now and then. I've nothing but good things to say about it. And I'm happy that it's getting a DLC and that it's been successful enough to merit that kind of support. It's made by Juicebox, who made Guacamelee, so that will give you some idea of the tone and humour and colour of the game. Nobody Saves the World is a really good game. It's been a bit of a slow burn, but I'm determined to finish it this year, and maybe I will end up doing a whole episode about the game once I've worked my way through it. But if you're thinking of doing it, Frozen Hearth DLC is out now as well, so there is more game for you to enjoy. But what I've been playing this week mainly has been a little bit of Rogue Legacy 2. I've been playing like half an hour after work, just doing a few runs. It's that kind of game. It's a slick, hand-drawn roguelike. You will have heard me talk about it in the last few episodes. Lots of classes, lots of weapons, lots of upgrades. Lots of stuff that carries on from run to run, so you feel like you never have a wasted run. Something that I really like. It's hard, but fair. And I've been continuing to play it. And the reason that I'm bringing it up now is that there was something that I came across that really made me warm to it even more, and that was teleporters. Throughout a single run of this game, you will encounter teleporters. There is one in the first room where you enter the castle that you're trying to invade. When you come to a significant location, such as a boss door or the start of another biome, there'll be a teleporter there, and in your run, you can use it. You can use it to go back to the start if you want. But I never really used them. They didn't really seem to serve much purpose. But I met an NPC in my last run. I got as far as I've ever gotten into the game, and she offered to unlock them permanently for quite a substantial amount of money. And so you have to earn like 1,700 coins in a single run, which is a pretty good run, to be honest, at least at the stage that I am at now in the game. But if you pay her that, she'll open a teleporter, for example, at the start of World 2, which is by the docks. And from that point on, you can immediately, upon entering the castle, skip the first biome completely and start the second world. And this blew my mind. Like, roguelikes seem to delight in making the player run through a repetitive gauntlet. You have to fight the first boss again and again and again. You have to get through the first biome every time you want to get to the second. Looking at you here, Returnal, looking at games like Dead Cells. And I love games that see that it's a flaw, see that it's boring, and actually just fix it. So the fact that Rogue Legacy 2 has looked at the genre, smashed up the template and said, you know, if you beat a boss, you've beaten that boss. If you unlock a teleporter, you can skip to that place. And I'm 8 hours in, and I feel that my time has now been rewarded, that they have seen that I'm invested in the game, and they're like, yeah, sure, okay. So players that make it this far, you are entitled to just try and make your way through this game and get further. So shout out to Rogue Legacy 2. That's a wonderful design choice in that game. It continues to go up in my estimation, and I will continue to play it. I also played a little bit of the Harvestella demo. This is a game I talked about earlier. I mentioned earlier, at least. It's by Square Enix Montreal. It is a JRPG mixed with a farming game. That's the basic elevator pitch. In this game, you play as a beautiful JRPG waifu in the usual designer angular garment and stockings and whatnot, except you land in an alien world and you are given a farm plot and you start farming as well as trying to save the world. So it's full-on JRPG disaster movie with a highfalutin fantasy plotline mixed with a full-on farming game. So as you kill monsters in dungeons, you are rewarded sometimes with seeds or with tools. There is a village with a shop, a blacksmith that can upgrade your weapons, various currencies. And as farming games go, I have to say this one is pretty convenient. There is a chest next to your plot where you can dump all the things that you've grown. They will automatically be sold at the end of the day, and your money will just go into your account. It's very much like medieval PayPal, and then you'll just have your money to go and pay the blacksmith and hand over your copper ore or whatever and get a plus one sword. The movement is really nice in this game, if a little floaty, as all JRPGs are. I have not played a JRPG that feels like it has a weighty protagonist. They all just seem to dance through the world in a way that is very insubstantial and disconnected, but that's just the style of the genre. I would say the graphics are pretty nice in this one, even though they were a little grainy and blurry on my Switch screen. The style is nice. I was impressed with the quality of life stuff in farming. For example, if you're watering, you can hit water and move at the same time so that you can water large areas pretty quickly. There's a little flash on each tile as it reaches the optimal amount of being watered. So that was really fun. I quite like the combat. It's pretty basic. The numbers fly off the enemies as you hit them, that kind of thing. The menus were all quite good. I found that in farming games, often like how easily you can interact with your inventory, how easily you fill your inventory, what happens when you fill it, that kind of stuff. The quality of life is a big issue in the farming game genre, I think. And Harvestella does a really good job with it. I didn't hit any walls. Everything felt pretty intuitive. And I like the way that it mixes together JRPG story and combat and the progression systems that go with that, like an RPG mechanics, like leveling up and upgrading your equipment. And that's tied together with a farming economy. It's a good idea, you know. The dungeon that is in the demo reminded me a lot of Ni No Kuni, the first dungeon in that one, where you're running through a forest environment with clearings where there are monsters, with forking pathways, with shortcuts that you can open, that kind of thing. So far, so good. It's not all good, though. There is a weird day-night cycle, and the days are really short. If you get to midnight, your character literally passes out, wakes up in bed, and you have to pay someone a load of money to come and have collected you. And I often found myself going through the dungeon, making really good progress and feeling very excited and like, you know, like I was getting into the game. And then the time just got too short and I had to just quit what I was doing and come back the next day. And that's really a disastrous decision. No one's going to enjoy that. If you're doing the dungeon, you just want to do the dungeon. You don't want to have to go and take a nap. I don't know, maybe later in the game you can get espresso machine or something to keep your character awake through the night, or at least to stay up past bedtime. But at the moment, that's a big problem with this game. I would also say that there's a lot of invisible walls in this game. There is, for example, you get out of bed in the morning, but then you can't jump onto the bed, invisible wall. There's a beautiful glistening fountain. You can't jump into the fountain, invisible wall. As you're running through the village, there are small ankle-height stone walls with beautiful meadows behind them, but you can't jump over them and run in the meadows, invisible wall. So again, that's just a JRPG staple. They don't seem to care that much about traversal. But I find it a little frustrating. It makes me feel like I'm walking through a rope maze at an airport, you know, just being shepherded through rather than having agency and freedom, which does tend to get on my nerves a little bit. But I will say that Harvestella has kept my attention. I've been playing a little bit before bed. I think I'm a few hours in. It's a pretty substantial demo. So if you fancy the sound of that one, then you can play that demo now on Switch. The final game that I'm going to talk about before we get to The Beasts of Maravilla Island, this is one that I was looking forward to, actually, and I think a lot of people were. It's called Bear and Breakfast. It's by Gummy Cat. that first came to my attention in, I think, a Nintendo Direct. And it's fairly anticipated. It's a cute game. It's a hotel management sim where you play a bear who is running a bed and breakfast, therefore B&B, bear and breakfast. On Metacritic so far, it's had a 73, so middling to good. But a lot of people who seem to be excited about this game have gone a little quiet about it since release. I got a review copy and I have not played much of it, but I'm going to give you my thoughts on why that is. I really bounced hard on this game. I was looking forward to it. I like the art style. I like the concept. I like the fact that it has a hotel sim with a cute graphical style and also a bit of a spooky story plot. There is more to it than you would think for a simple resources and crafting game. There is a story that you can follow as well. And the idea of the bear running a B&B is just so cute, man. I was like, yeah, I'll try that. Unfortunately, I really could not play this game very well at all. I found that the controls were just atrocious. There is a menu system where you have to press a button to open the menu, and then within the menu, you have to press a button to open another menu, and then within that menu, you have to select the option you want and press a button that leads to another menu. And I just couldn't even, really. I was just feeling lost in the pages of this menu system and UI. There were some other problems too. The bear walks pretty slowly and bumps into everything, gets stuck on every little bit of scenery. You can't really see where the scenery ends and the non-traversable part begins because a lot of it is very dark. So it has a readability problem. The tutorials appear and cover half the screen and you can't get rid of them or click through them unless you've opened one of the specific menus first. So I found myself just jabbing buttons a lot, frustratedly trying to make things go away or trying to make things happen. There are several mechanics that are drag and drop sort of thing, or where you have to drag a square over an area. And it was just not explained very well. And so I found myself struggling with very basic tasks. I had a really hard time with this game. I played it 3 or 4 times, about 20 minutes each time, and just became incredibly frustrated by it. I was talking about this in the show's Discord, and a patron of the show called Arkan said that his wife is playing this game and said that she felt that it was great, but it felt like it was designed for a mouse. Mouse and keyboard controls. And I suddenly had a flash of understanding. So I was like, okay, now I understand. So if you're supposed to click where the bear goes, then it will just automatically find its way through obstacles. Whereas if you're on a controller, you're hitting every little obstacle and getting stuck. If you're supposed to drag a room on an empty building and then it is constructed, that makes so much sense because that's how we drag on a mouse. It's how we draw a square. It's how we use, for example, a spreadsheet. And so suddenly I thought, okay, this game is probably fine if you're playing on a mouse. So there is a possibility that I might ask for a code on Steam just to see if it fares better on computer. But as it stands, I can't really recommend it on the Switch, sad to say. So that's my take on trying out Bear and Breakfast. And before we get to the final review of the show, which is The Beasts of Maravilla Island, let me just briefly mention that this show is patron-supported. You can join up and support the show, help me upgrade my gear, buy the music that I use in the show, that kind of thing, for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. In exchange for that, you will get perks such as an invite to our Discord community, which is a really lovely little corner of the internet to talk about games. You will get occasional extra episodes about games or deep dives or spoiler casts or off-topic things. The last few have been about music and travel, traveling in Iceland, that kind of thing. So like these kind of diary travel episodes. If that sounds like fun to you, you can unlock all of those episodes by becoming a patron for $1, €1, or £1 a month at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. I will also say a big thank you to anyone that has left a rating for the podcast on Spotify or left a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or who has retweeted the show. I put up a little sample of each show on Twitter at Gaming in the Wild. So thank you very much to everyone that reviews and retweets and shares the show with friends. I really appreciate that and it helps the show to grow. And thank you very much to all my patrons too. And with all of that said, let's move on and talk about the featured game of this episode, the final game in this epic episode, Beasts of Maravilla Island. So Beasts of Maravilla Island, that's Maravilla spelt M-A-R-A-V-I-L-L-A. I was originally pronouncing it Maravilla, but I looked it up, it's a real place, it's Maravilla. So Beasts of Maravilla Island is a 2021 game developed by Banana Bird, published by Whitethorn Digital, with music that you've been hearing throughout this episode by Kyle Van Wittenberg and Tavi Zia. It's out on the Switch and the Xbox. I played it on Game Pass. It was a game that I found pretty randomly, and it's been sitting in my collection for quite a while. I downloaded it just because it looks cute. It had a beautiful, lush thumbnail, and seemed to be about photographing nature. I was quite into it. It gave me a little bit of an Eastshade vibe, if you've played that one. It's a game in which you make landscape paintings to progress the story. And so there it sat for a really long time, until I was just feeling like trying something out, and I was just scanning through the 40 or so games that I have on my Xbox and decided to fire it up. It's a short game, this one. It's only 2 hours to complete, but that feels like a comfortable length for this game. On Metacritic, it has a 59 from only a handful of reviews. That includes a low of a 40 and a high of an 83. So opinion is a little split, but it didn't get any, you know, 10 out of 10s or anything. I think if I was reviewing this one, I'd probably come down somewhere in the middle, somewhere around 75, maybe 7 out of 10, something like that. So actually on the higher end. And the way that the developers describe this game is, Beasts of Maravilla Island is a 3D adventure game where you take on the role of a young wildlife photographer who traverses Maravilla Island's magical ecosystems to discover extraordinary creatures, learn their behaviours, and most importantly, photograph their majesty. And my take on this one is that it's a short, simple, lo-fi wildlife photography game that managed in its 2 hour runtime to make me slow down, look around, and smell the virtual flowers. So it's a short game, it's an indie game, it's a 3D game. The graphics are low poly but very colourful and stylized. So you are running through a 3D environment, taking photographs of all of the wonderful creatures that you find. It is quite linear with a few branching paths, but it's basically a story game. And the story begins when you, playing as Maria Montez, a young wildlife photographer, lands on the shores of Maravilla Island, and she's following in the footsteps of her grandfather, who left her his journal. And his journal has an account of his journey through this mythic island where he found the most majestic, fantastical nature he'd ever seen. He makes drawings in his journal, these beautiful pencil drawings and handwritten accounts of the beast's behaviours and that kind of thing. It's wonderfully handled in the game. And that's the premise. Maria has come to this island because her grandfather wanted her to see it, and she wanted to follow in his footsteps. It's a cute story, and it's a good start to the game. The game begins when you are dropped off on the beach of the island. There is a path leading over some rocks and into the trees, and off you go, basically. I took to this one like a duck to water. The first thing that I saw was that there are creatures everywhere. There are bugs flying around, there are little beetles on the ground, there are birds, there are flora and fauna, all kinds of plants just growing everywhere. My eye went to them very naturally, so I think that a great job was done with the visual design in this game. It felt very fluid to me to just notice the things that were around me. And before even having the tutorial, I was already holding down L2 button to aim and the R2 button to take a photograph, use the D-pad to zoom in and out. And then when you take a photo of a creature, it goes into your journal. You can flick through the journal and see all of the creatures that you've discovered, such as a ruby beetle, which was the first thing that I found. And at the same time as I was looking at my picture in the journal, I noticed that there were some aims for this area, this first forest area. One of them was to photograph six insects, six flowers, and an animal doing a few different things. And so this you know, I was hooked. I was in. I was like, oh, hell yeah, I want to find the six insects. What are they? I was very curious. I was excited. Like, the premise just works for me. The gameplay just works for me. I liked the controls, even though I will say it's a lo-fi game. It's a little bit basic in some ways, but I was taken by the sense of wonder of wandering into this tree canopy and all of the strange things that I would find there. It just hooked me. And the first section of the game is pretty great, actually. You're just running through the forest floor, finding flowers. Some flowers react to the flash of your camera, and they open and make things happen, such as, you know, platforms that you can use, that kind of thing, or climbing walls that will drop down vines. And there are different little avenues for you to wander down between the trees. And at the end of each pathway, there is usually something to discover, such as an insect or a flower. Even if it's very small and you have to look around, I had a sense that something was there. And if you point your camera, a little text dialogue appears telling you if you've seen this thing before, or a question mark appears if you have not, and you know it's something new. So there's a very fluid system of recognizing things that you have or have not captured before. I enjoyed doing all of the challenges. My favorites involved learning things about the environment that you're in and observing things. For example, without wishing to give away spoilers, there is an early puzzle where you hear an animal call, and you can whistle, but you have to whistle in a certain rhythm to imitate that call. And if you do that, then the animal will be revealed and you can photograph it, and you get a tick in your journal and you get a nice photograph, a nice moment, and also a nice feeling of having observed the ecosystem and interacted with it and then gotten a pleasant result out of it. So I really enjoyed that. I found myself just with wide eyes, just scouring every portion of this intro area in case I missed anything. And that's such a nice feeling to have in a game. Often I will find myself almost accidentally speedrunning portions of games when I know that there is nothing much for me to find, really, apart from maybe some barrels to smash to get, you know, a heart or some currency or some bushes to cut to get herbs or whatever. In this game, it felt like there could be something wonderful anywhere that you could look. And that's really special, I think. But I do think that whilst talking about this game, I don't know what you have in your mind's eye right now, but I think I have to mention again that this is a very simple game. This is a very clearly a small team indie game. It doesn't look like Eastshade, really, which looks like a Skyrim level of graphics. This looks simpler than that. It has low poly graphics that could maybe be from the PS3 era. And the paths are very simple. The gameplay is very simple and a little clunky outside of the photography. For example, jumping, running over things. But I found myself going slowly. I found myself searching corners. And so the gameplay had a unique feeling to me, even though the game looks and feels fairly simple or old. I just found myself going to the end of every path, and usually being rewarded with another photograph of a light bug from my journal, or like seeing a new bird just calling somewhere. It was like taking my foot off the gas and slowing down. And that's something that I feel kind of grateful for, actually. This game gave me a feeling that I don't think I've had, really, before playing a video game. It was a little bit like if you're on a hike and you notice a beautiful orchid growing just between the rocks and you lean down to look at it. Like, the sensation that you get at those moments of noticing and being observant and allowing yourself to be pulled into the land and pulled into the experience that you're having was neatly mirrored in this simple little game, in a way that I really appreciated. it's quite telling too that the sounds that we're playing now, the soundscape of Maravilla Island, is something that was included in the soundtrack when I downloaded it on Bandcamp to use in the show. And that says a lot about this game, I think. There's a simple story here too about the island, your grandpa. It's all over in 2 hours. It's neat and tidy. I barely remembered the time when I was playing this one, honestly. I was just really absorbed in it. So let's go through a few pluses and minuses. I would say that the simple graphics are pretty nice here. They get the job done. They read well. They use neon, pastel, light, and height pretty well. All pretty well. And they're rudimentary, sure, but they're really well done. I would say that this game gave me a sense of wonder. I gasped a couple of times to catch a glimpse of a new animal. I liked the simple story. I liked the grandpa's journal. The notebook was very nicely written, very authentic feeling and homemade. The pencil drawings were lovely. The notes about animal behaviours were lovely. I don't want to give you any spoilers here, but you do have to pay attention to the animals to really get the most out of the game. If you want to photograph all of their behaviours, you have to pay attention and learn how they do things and try and get them to act certain ways, to solve certain puzzles and to get them to do things for pictures and that kind of thing. That was a really nice feeling of interacting with an ecosystem in a non-intrusive way. It's a non-violent game. I enjoyed that the 2 hour runtime makes it very gentle, very easy to access, very pleasurable. You're not committing here to a big experience. You're committing to a finely crafted small one. It has directional audio. I played with headphones on late at night, and I could hear where animal sounds were coming from around me. I could hear an unfamiliar bird call coming from behind me and to the left, for example, and I knew that I should look that way to try and find what I was looking for. There are some puzzles. They're simple. They're super chill. There's one where you have to use reflective snail shells, or you have to use bait to make animals come forward, that kind of thing. Also, it's bug-free and clean. No crashes, no issues, nothing like that. So the minuses for this game, it's pretty lo-fi. I think a lot of people might bounce off it. Has a little bit of jank, like the character runs slowly and will sometimes bump into bits of scenery in strange ways, or have a jumping animation that doesn't quite happen. There is no jump button, you just push forward and your character automatically does things. I had to run into the trigger point a couple times sometimes to make them do that thing. For some people, I think the simplicity of this game will be boring, but for me it was genuinely an upside. This really hit the spot. Super simple gameplay is just what I was after. This game did me proud in that regard. Some of the reviews said that this is a Pokemon Snap clone. I haven't played Pokemon Snap, so that seemed to be one of the big critiques. I will say that this game is free moving, whereas Pokemon Snap seems to be on rails. And I think that did a big service to my experience in this game. I had some agency. I could circle back if I felt like I'd missed something, and I did several times. If I got to the end of one of the 4 levels without completing my book, I would go back and look for that final bug. And so to finish off, I will say the main thing that you have to do in this game is to be observant. You have to notice the things around you. You have to slow down. And the fact that the game encourages that is almost like a meditation. It gave me a feeling I don't often get in games, of just being very engrossed in what I'm doing at a very slow, lovely pace. There is a moral to the game that is about witnessing and respecting and capturing nature, to be curious and to be observant and to be open to wonder. And I mean, that's a very noble aim for a game. It's a very noble aim for this little indie game, and I'm very grateful to have played it. That is Beasts of Maravilla Island. So that's our episode. I hope you enjoyed it. This was a pretty packed one with all of that news, with all of those games. This has run long. We're getting towards the hour mark. The podcast doesn't normally hit an hour. But I hope you enjoyed hearing about that. I would love to hear from you guys. I would love to hear your thoughts on the direct, on the state of play. If you think that I underplayed what was on show at the Xbox showcase, please let me know what I should be looking at. If you've got opinions on where Assassin's Creed is going, come tweet at me or talk to me on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Twitch, YouTube, all at Gaming in the Wild. You can find links to all of that at gaminginthewild.com. There is also a link there to come and join the show's Patreon. You are welcome to join our community and show your support for the show. I'd like to thank everyone who is a patron, everyone who takes part in the Discord. I've been finding loads of new games through the Discord lately. I love seeing what people are playing, hearing what they like, hearing their opinions. It's a really fun, agreeable place. You know, people are very mild-mannered and pleasant there. It's just a lovely place to be. So thanks to all of the patrons, thanks to all of the Discord people. That's our episode. I'll be back next week with a new one. Maybe I'll finally get stuck into Immortality. Maybe I will play Metal Hellsinger, just completely out of character, and go full Doom Eternal. And maybe I'll tuck into Four Tales, or Blossom Tales 2 will suck me in. Not sure what it'll be about, but it'll be something good, I promise you. Thanks very much for listening. Take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.